on the weathered signboard, and I gave a shiver of pleasure. The ghost of Canon Whitbread might, even at this moment, be peeping round one of those old weather-blasted tombstones, looking over my shoulder. As I stared up at the square tower, I had the distinct feeling that someone was watching us, but in a moment it had passed. Churches can do that to you. In the porch, Feely made a beeline up the curving stone steps to the organ loft, and I took a pew at the front on the centre aisle. There is nowhere you can feel the presence of the dead more than in the damp dimness of an empty church. If you listen, you can hear them breathing. I know that makes no sense, because the dead don't breathe, at least in an earthly way. But you can hear them nonetheless. I turned up the volume on my almost supernatural hearing. This was a trait I had inherited from my dead mother Harriet, which, although generally a pain in the ear, sometimes came in handy. But if the dead were whispering today, they were not addressing me. Perhaps the lady victims of Canon Whitbread were gathering round the communion rail for a jolly good chinwag. Wasn't it, after all, the very spot where they had been poisoned? I stared at the altar with new interest. Was there a slight shimmering of the air? If so, it was nothing you could put your finger on. A thermal of warm air, perhaps, set into motion by the outside temperature. A silent gust from one of the underfloor heating ducts. It was either moving air or ancient holiness, and if I had to make a bet, I'd put my money on a cold draught. After a few hollow knocks and the rustle of paper somewhere at the back of the church, the organ began to speak. I recognized the melody at once. Johann Sebastian Bach's The Art of Fugue. It began with the note of a single pipe, which sounded at first like a dry bone singing itself to sleep in a crypt somewhere in the night. But it wasn't long before the other bones joined in. Bach's playful organ notes rising and flitting about high up among the rafters and hammer beams like a squadron of deliriously happy bats. An apt comparison, if I do say so myself, since the word fugue means flight. Oh, it was delicious. I sighed, took a deep breath, and closed my eyes. Old Johann Sebastian, I decided, must have had a mind like mine, capable of being everywhere at once. I have always found organ music to be great fertilizer for thoughts. With Bach in my ears and no distractions, my mind accelerated like a greyhound let off the leash. Who was the dead Orlando, and who was the woman in the bath chair? What was the relationship between them? Why had she reacted so vigorously when I told her he was dead? More important, what was the meaning of the numbers I had found in the corpse's pocket? My eyes popped open at the thought, and were drawn immediately to the numbers posted on the hymn boards above the pulpit and the lectern. These were, of course, the hymns which were to be sung at the next service, or had already been sung at the last one. Three only were listed, hymns 289, 172, and 584. I swiveled round and plucked a copy of Hymns Ancient and Modern, Ancient and Laundered, as Daffy calls it, from the rack on the back of my pew. I thumbed my way to hymn 289. Days and moments quickly flying, blend the living with the dead. Soon will you and I be lying, each within his narrow bed. How I adore hymns! They have a sense of perspective that's all too often missing in everyday life. Not much correspondence, though, with the numbers in the corpse's pocket. I called to mind the wrinkled bit of paper. 54, 6, 7, 8, 9, it had said. Well, the 8 and the 9 of the first hymn number were the same, but it wasn't enough. 2 numbers out of 6 wins nothing on the lottery, and it didn't hear either. I turned to hymn 172. Praise to the holiest in the height, and in the depths be praise. This was more like it. I couldn't help but think of the dead Orlando, whom I had dredged from the depths, although I doubt if he was doing much praising about his predicament. But for this hymn, only the 7 tallied. Worse odds than the previous one. What if the numbers referred to hymns 54, 67, and 89? My thumbs became a blur. Hymn 54 seemed promising. When shades of night around us close, and weary limbs in sleep repose. But from there, it quickly wandered off into pity, guilt, and misery. I flipped to hymn 67. The 3rd verse had blood and water, and the 4th, something about landing on the eternal shore. I sighed and went on to 89, which was about Moses fasting, not particularly promising. But then I remembered, hymns ancient and modern wasn't the only flounder in the sea. No, indeed. The church, for as long as I could remember, had been tinkering with the hymnal and the prayer book so much as to make your head spin. Sunday morning services were like a steeplechase as we fanned pages in the next jump to get to the proper place. And then, of course, there was the English hymnal. That in itself was an entirely different kettle of fish. Were all these fishy thoughts a kind of blasphemy? I decided not. Wasn't the fish, after all, as much a symbol of Christianity as the cross? I twisted round again in my seat, actually got on to my knees on the pew, so that, facing backward, I could dig more deeply. I was going to say fish, but I won't, in the book rack behind me. And yes, as I somehow knew it would be, not far from my searching fingertips, was a rather tattered copy of the English hymnal. This was larger, fatter than hymns A and M, due, of course, to the fact that it contained not only the words of the hymns with their titles in Greek and Latin, but also the music, as well as footnotes. This was an industrial-sized hymn book intended for experts. I turned to hymn 54. Ye clouds of darkness, hosts of night, that breed confusion and affright, be gone, etc. Could it have been a warning? That seemed unlikely. I paged ahead to number 67. Now is the healing time decreed. Healing, perhaps, but disappointing. Now only hymn 89 was left. My fingers were already feeling defeated. But wait, here it was. Soul of Jesus, make me whole. Meek and contrite make my soul. Thou, most stainless soul divine, cleanse this sordid soul of mine. I gave an involuntary shiver. Could this be a personal message from the universe to Flavia Deluce? Was it like one of those oracles where you stuck your finger into the pages of the Bible at random and read out the text from wherever it landed? I had seen Feely do this once, but only once. "What shall I wear when Dieter takes me to the cinema on Saturday night?" she had asked. But when the Bible had replied, "My flesh is clothed with worms and clods," Job chapter 7 verse 5, she had let out an unearthly shriek and cancelled her date. The hymn went on to talk about curses and ransoms, but not until the later verses. In my opinion, no one sending an encrypted threat would make use of any but the opening words. Otherwise, it would be too obscure. The intended victim would become bored and give it up before getting to the message. I could see that the hymn book idea was a washout, and I returned it to its rack. Beside the 2 hymnals was a 3rd book, thick and black, loose and battered from much use. Not expecting much, I picked it up. The Holy Bible, King James Version. It was as heavy as a brick. Acting upon a sudden impulse, I shoved my forefinger in among its pages. Her princes within her are roaring lions, her judges are evening wolves, they gnaw not the bones till the morrow. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 3. So much for oracles, I thought. But, believe it or not, at that very instant, an idea came flying out of nowhere and landed on my head like a pigeon on Lord Nelson's statue. I turned to the front of the Bible, praying desperately for a table of contents. Yes, here it was, just as you would expect, at the beginning. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. A cold hand touched my bare arm. I leapt at least 2 feet into the air, and my pounding heart cowered behind my kidneys. "I thought I'd find you here," said a voice at my ear, and I spun round in a state that was close to terror. It was a woman from the river bank. Once again, she had rolled up behind me in utter silence. With my back turned to the altar and the music from the organ, I had not seen or heard her bath chair coming. She must have entered the church through the transept. "We got off on the wrong foot out there," she said, jerking a thumb toward the churchyard. "My fault entirely. You were only trying to help poor Orlando. I should have realized that at once." She must have seen my astonishment. Could this be the same person who, not all that long ago, had been tearing out her hair on the river bank? "You must have been longing to slap my face, mustn't you? Oh, go ahead, admit it. I shouldn't have blamed you if you had." I gave her one of those grim fishhooks in the corners of the mouth smiles and turned my attention back to the open Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. "Tell me you forgive me," she said, giving my arm a tug. "The vicar and the constable advised me to come into the church and compose myself, which is what I am attempting to do. But you must help me." I tried to ignore her, but it was not easy. "Here," she said, shoving a hand in my face. "Shake. I'm Poppy Mandrill, and who, pray tell, are you?"
"Titania Bottom," I replied, as I sometimes do when I'm annoyed.
The woman threw back her head and laughed, a surprisingly rich, warm, throaty laugh that flew up and joined the flitting notes of the organ.
"Come off it," she said. "I've directed enough Shakespeare in my time to know when my leg's being pulled."
She tapped her right knee, or at least where her right knee ought to have been, but wasn't. I noticed for the first time that she was lacking a leg. Until now, the blanket in her lap had hidden the missing member.
I'm sorry, I said, feeling like a chump.
"Don't be," she replied. "I'm not. It's curiously liberating in a way. Oh, don't give me that look of pitying skepticism. I'm sick and tired of people looking at me like that. They don't know what to make of me. I may be lacking a leg, but there's nothing wrong with my brain."
I had to admit to myself, grudgingly, that there was something in this woman I admired. I made a sudden decision and thrust out my hand. "Flavia Deluce," I said, looking her in the eye as I gave her a firm old handshake to make up for my insolence.
"Tell me about Orlando," I went on, while our palms were still touching. "I feel so sorry for him."
She studied my face closely. "And besides, I'm curious," I added.
"Fair enough," she said. "I believe you."
"Orlando was my protégé."
An interesting word, that. I knew that it came from a French word meaning to protect. Feely's organ teacher, Mr. Collicutt, always referred to her as his protégé. At least, he always did before he was murdered. But if Mr. Collicutt ever fancied he was protecting Feely from anything, he must have had the brains of a trilobite. My sister was born with the defensive instincts of a tiger shark. No, there was another sense to the word, meaning a student or pupil. That must be it.
"You were his teacher?" I asked.
Miss Mandrill sized me up before answering.
"In a sense, yes,"
she said at last. I had learned some years ago by observing my friend Inspector Hewitt of the Hindley Constabulary that the best way to elicit further information is by keeping one's mouth firmly shut. I said nothing, and by Jehoshaphat, it worked. Orlando was a very talented actor, she explained. He might have become the greatest of our age, or of any other, had he lived. Another Gielgud, who knows, perhaps even greater than Gielgud. He had the sensitivity and the steel combined, that precious alloy so lacking in so many of today's footlight trotters. All he lacked was opportunity, and now even that seems to have been snatched away from him. By whom, I wondered grammatically? By fate? Or was Miss Mandrill suggesting that something much more sinister had taken place? I thrust my face slightly forward to indicate intense interest. "Well," she continued, giving her head a shake, "wherever he is now, he will be laughing at his own tragedy. That's how it's done, you know. That is the secret of true greatness." "She's right," I thought. "I don't know how many times I've laughed aloud at the very thought of my own not inconsiderable talents." I smiled modestly. "And where do you suppose he is?" I asked, sneaking the question in under the wire, so to speak. "Orlando." She spoke his name with a little laugh. "Oh, he'll be perching on the edge of some mauve-tinged cloud, wiggling his toes, sipping a glass of absinthe, and chummying up to one of our more outré dead novelists, Ronald Fairbank, or one of that lot." "Not Shakespeare?" I asked, surprised. "Shakespeare?" Miss Mandrill repeated, making a prune mouth. "Good Lord, no. Orlando detested Shakespeare. High-blown muck, he used to say, the lot of it, like an explosion in a pigsty." I couldn't help sucking in my breath. "Good thing Daffy isn't here," I thought. "She would have pulverized the woman for even repeating such sacrilege."
"I detect your disagreement," said Miss Mandrill. "It's written all over your face. Oh, well, I suppose there are people you can talk sense with, and others whom you can't."
How was I going to deal with this woman? One moment she was confiding in me like an old pal, and the next she was shooting at me with flaming arrows. I couldn't afford to stalk off in high dudgeon, as Mrs. Mullet once put it, nor could I waste time playing on again, off again, with such a wandering mind. It was like playing at bowls on a teeter-totter. Of course the woman was upset. Who wouldn't be to find their protégé dragged drowned from the drink and spread-eagled on a patch of grass? "Had he any relatives?" I asked. "Anyone who ought to be informed?"
"Ha!"
she barked, and left it at that. Feely by now had reached one of the quieter parts of the Art of Fugue, and the organ's notes, rather than flying and fluttering about, now roosted, whispering, up among the ancient timbers. In the near silence I heard the sound of approaching footsteps on the wooden floor, and it wasn't the sidesman bringing the collection plate to the altar rail. It was the police.
"Constable Otter, miss," said an onion-scented voice at my ear. "A word outside, if you please."
I gave an eye-shrug to Miss Mandrill, crossed myself ostentatiously, you never knew, got to my feet and followed the constable up the aisle and out into the sunshine, blinking madly at the glare. I noted at once that the constable had had the good sense to come for me alone.
"Now then," Constable Otter said, flipping open the pages of his notebook and licking the end of an indelible pencil, and I knew that I was, so to speak, home free.
Chapter 4.
I cannot pretend that it was unpleasant to be questioned by the police. I had in the past become quite accustomed to occasional quiet chats with Inspector Hewitt, chats during which, as often as not, I was able to set the inspector straight on some of the finer points of chemistry, and even, on one or two occasions, certain other matters as well. Although I would have preferred to be grilled by the detective branch, I was nevertheless quite gracious to the uniformed Constable Otter. I put him at his ease at once. "Ah, you've tracked me down at last," I said in an admiring voice. "Nothing like a mysterious death to liven up a lazy summer day, eh, Constable?" I'd show him that I was an old hand at this sort of thing. He gave me rather an odd squint. "Is it the sun?" I wondered, "or have I misjudged the man?"
"Mysterious, miss?" the constable asked. "Careful, Flavia," I thought. This man was quicker on the uptake than I had given him credit for.
"Well, you know what I mean," I improvised. "Drowned, but not reported missing?"
"And how do you know that?"
I could tell at once that Constable Otter was far from being the dullest blade in the drawer. In fact, I was already foreseeing great things for him in the future. "By deduction," I said, "one would expect to find searchers on the banks, the river being dragged and so forth." Constable Otter scratched the tip of his chin with the point of his pencil. It left a small indigo mark, but I didn't point it out to him.
"Well, miss," he said, "I expect we ought to leave such deductions, as you call them, to the professionals, the chaps with the brains and the microscopes."
The constable was being witty, but I pretended not to notice. He must have misread the look on my face, because he added,
"A microscope, miss, in case you didn't know, is a device for magnifying small or minuscule objects. It makes a flea's eye look as broad as a barn."
Obviously, he did not realize that he was speaking to a person who had at home, in her own personal chemical laboratory, one of the finest binocular microscopes ever crafted by Ernst Leitz of Wetzlar, and that she bloody well knew how to use it.
"Idiot."
"No, really?" I asked, letting the words writhe out of my mouth like a snake from a basket, and letting my jaw fall open the regulation 3 inches.
"Hmm," he said, giving me that narrow look of his again. "Are you a professional, miss?"
His unexpectedly perceptive question caught me off guard. "Well, yes," I said. "In a way, I suppose you could say I am." My reply was greeted with silence. This man had all the makings of a chief inspector. I'd better watch my step.
More important, I'd better get on the right side of him.
"You're very good at what you do, you know," I said.
"Better not butter him up too much, though," I thought, "otherwise I might slip and fall on my face."
He was giving me that look again, but I was saved from embarrassment by a cry from the water's edge.
"Constable! Constable Otter!"
It was the vicar, and he was waving his arms in rather an unholy manner, more like a railway guard, I thought. With great deliberation, Constable Otter returned his notebook and pencil to the breast pocket of his uniform. He was not a man to be stampeded. With one last quizzing look at me, he turned and strode off purposefully along the path, his police boots crunching without mercy on the gravel. Naturally, I followed. He had not instructed me to stay where I was. Although our skiff was still at the river bank, Dogger and Daffy were nowhere in sight. They must still be at the Oak and Pheasant, where Dogger would be doing his best to distract Daffy, to keep her mind and eyes away from the corpse. In spite of her steel-hard exterior, my sister was the tenderest of us all. She simply hated to show it. When the cards were down, Daffy was always the first to fold. Anything truly gruesome, such as an arm or a leg broken in a tumble from a tree, or a toad speared on the tines of a garden fork, would reduce Daffy to a quivering, helpless jelly. The sight, or even the smell of blood, caused her to drop her dinner on the spot, as if her brain and belly were connected by a string. But books were another matter. As long as it was only described in print, with no pictures, my sister could stomach anything. Hadn't she read aloud to me with great enthusiasm, when I was still a child, the scene from Crime and Punishment, in which Raskolnikov hacks two women to death with an axe? And she had positively burbled with delight at the death by pistol of Vladimir in Eugene Onyegin, in which his blood gushed, smoking from the wound. Books served Daffy as an insulation between the real world and her tender heart. As for me, I was not like that at all. No, not in the least. To me, an unexamined corpse was a tale untold, a knotted ball of a tale that was simply crying out to be unravelled until the last strand had been picked free. The fact that it was also a study in progressively putrid chemistry simply made it all that much more lively and interesting. My point is that although there were obviously certain similarities between Daffy and myself, there were also insurmountable, in this life at least, differences. The vicar was still making wigwag signals with his arms as I approached, just a few steps behind Constable Otter. "I thought you ought to see this," he was saying, holding out a sodden slipper. It was red, a perfect match for the single one the corpse was wearing.
"Where did you get this, then?" the constable demanded in rather a gruff voice.
It had been my experience that the police do not like evidence to be discovered by anyone but themselves.
"There," said the vicar, pointing a semi-accusing finger at a rather ragamuffin lad who stood nearby beside the wreckage of a sodden kite. I hadn't even noticed him.
"Hob Nightingale," the vicar said.
I turned my attention to this grubby child who was staring attentively down at his oversized boots. Just a couple of years younger than me, he might well have been a porter at Covent Garden Market, an orphan waif from one of Daffy's Dickens novels. From his peaked cap and baggy rumpled trousers, I knew at once that he almost certainly had an older brother, and no mother.
"What you staring at, then?"
he asked, looking up and meeting my eye aggressively. "Sorry," I said, and I meant it. I have a tendency to gawk when I'm fascinated. He tossed his head and looked away. People who have been offended are entitled to a short sulk, as long as it doesn't drag on too long. I would have to wait a while to see if my apology had been accepted.
"Young Hob here was flying his kite," the vicar said. "A little gust brought it down among those reeds."
He pointed to a brackish bit of river bank, where a stretch of reeds and pondweed lined an indent in the river's course.
"Just over there," the vicar said, pointing.
"Floating, was it,
the slipper?"
Constable Otter asked.
"In the water, like?"
The vicar nodded.
"And who fished it out, then?"
the constable asked slyly.
"Why, I did," the vicar replied sheepishly,
and I noticed for the first time that his trouser legs were rolled up to reveal a stretch of white ecclesiastical legs and a pair of fish-white feet.
"Hob pointed it out. I waded in to retrieve it. He's just a child," he added. "I didn't want him to tumble in."
"I see," Constable Otter said, weighing the dripping slipper in his hand.
"So you fished it out yourself, with your own hands."
The vicar nodded meekly, and the constable, producing pad and pencil with the flourish of a stage magician, made a note in his book. There would be no catching out this stickler for detail at the inquest.
"Now then," the constable said, turning to the scowling Hob Nightingale. "What were you up to? No fibs, mind, else I'll tell your dad. He'll know what to do with you."
I blanched on the boy's behalf. I knew all too well what it felt like to be on the receiving end of a naked threat. But I needn't have bothered.
"Go ahead and tell him. I don't care," Hobbs said, staring Constable Otter in the eye. "I wasn't doing anything wrong. Since when is it a crime to fly a kite?"
The constable was as taken aback as I was. He removed his helmet and scratched the back of his head with his pencil. I wondered idly if he'd placed an indelible mark up there as well.
"Since when?"
Hob persisted, his voice rising slightly, just enough to threaten a full-scale tantrum.
"Now then, little laddie," the constable said, "no need to get your nappies in a knot."
He turned to the vicar, expecting a smile at such rapier wit, but his little joke died on the vine. The vicar stared at him as blankly as if he were one of Einstein's equations on a blackboard.
"Well then," Otter said, "run along home now. If I need anything else, I know where to find you."
And suddenly I saw the way, as if the sun had popped out from behind a black cloud and lighted a path through the woods.
"I'll take him home," I said. "I can help carry his broken kite."
I almost stressed the word broken, but was able to suppress the urge before it passed my lips. I had spotted a shape beneath the rumpled paper that was certainly not part of the flying apparatus.
"You don't even know where I live," Hob protested.
"Never mind, sweetie," I said, hating myself as I said it. "You can show me the way. I'm a wizard with broken kites." I bent and gathered up the soggy bundle of balsa wood, paper and string, of which there seemed to be an exceptional mess, taking care to keep the object beneath it out of sight. As a safeguard, I wrapped the long tail of paper bows around my forearm to seal the bundle shut.
"Lead on then, Hob," I said, in a mock dramatic voice.
Tossing his head up and his shoulders back, as if he were leading an army out of captivity in one of those stirring war films, Hob strode off through the churchyard, and I, with the shattered kite bundled awkwardly in my arms, followed him humbly. No one would ever suspect me of removing evidence from the scene of a crime. Hob did not so much as glance back at me. I might have been a mere servant carrying the train of his robe. We made our way past the church, into the high street, and then into a narrow passageway that ran between a greengrocer's and an undertaker's. On the right was a brick wall, and on the left a tall wooden fence.
"In here," Hob said,
speaking for the first time since leaving the churchyard. I stopped in my tracks, staring up at the painted sign on a weathered board above an open gate. "F.T. Nightingale," it read. "Funerals, etc."
"Wait,"
I said, but Hob shushed me with a finger raised to his lips.
"Keep it down," he whispered. "I don't want Dar to hear us."
"Dar?" I whispered back.
"My father," he said, pointing up to the sign. "The undertaker."
You could have knocked me over with an ostrich feather. It's not often that fate deals you a winning hand, but I'd just been given four aces and a joker up my sleeve.
"The undertaker," I murmured. "Fancy that." "Nothing to be afraid of," Hob said, miming the words in an exaggerated manner with his lips.
"Are you sure?" I mimed back. He did not reply, but, beckoning me with a curled forefinger, led the way into the fenced area. Inside was a broad, cobbled courtyard, and I found myself in another century. From the gas lamp above the back door of the premises to the cast-iron hitching posts, it was clearly a place where funerals had been marshalled before their procession to the graveyard. I could imagine the black horses standing patiently as they were harnessed for the hearse, which would have been a shellacked and solemn thing on slender wooden wheels, with unnerving slabs of glass all the way round, so that those fortunate enough to be still alive could have a jolly good gawk at the coffin as they envisioned its grisly contents. There would have been cockades attached, of black-dyed ostrich feathers, designed to ruffle in the breeze like the feathers of dead birds, which they were, to generate a primitive shudder in the spectators and remind them of their own mortality. There would have been mutes in tall black hats to pace numbly alongside the hearse and catch the eye of anyone they could, as if to say, "You! You there! Yes, you! You who might be next!" Oh, for the good old days, I thought, when death was an everyday equal, and not to be padlocked away like some dim-witted relative whom nobody wanted to see or spend time with. Today, at the door where once the horses were persuaded not to prance, stood a rather elderly and down-at-the-heels motor hearse, an Austin, I noted, which had apparently served in a former life as a London taxicab. Looking round, it was obvious to me that this courtyard was the rear of the undertaking premises, and not meant for public viewing. Wooden coffin cases leaned heavily against the fence, and boxes full of empty bottles were stacked in every corner. Embalming liquids, I noted appreciatively. I leaned over for a closer look at one of the weathered labels. Aha! Just as I suspected! Formaldehyde, mercury chloride, arsenious acid, with a pinch of good old sodium chloride, table salt, plus a couple of drops of thymol, oil of cinnamon, and oil of cloves, to mask the stink. I recalled with a delicious shiver that arsenious acid, in the form of arsenic trioxide, is one of the deadliest of poisons and is often used to dispatch rats.
"Hurry up!" Hob hissed.
He was standing in an open doorway, fanning frantically with his hands. I followed eagerly. I let out a low whistle. We were in a large workshop, at the far end of which was a raised loft or gallery. Coffins and parts of coffins in various stages of construction were everywhere, resting on wooden trestles, leaning against walls, piled in corners. Planes, hammers, saws and chisels covered every level surface, and the air was sweet with the smell of sawdust and wood shavings. To a girl of my interests, the place seemed like heaven. It was like being in on the creation. Hob was already halfway up the ladder that led to the loft.
"Up here," he said. "Hurry up. Hustle your bustle."
I obeyed, dragging myself unsteadily up, rung by rung, with the crumpled kite pressed against my bosom. I must have looked like an apprentice paper hanger. Hob reached out a hand to help me up onto the platform. Without any further ado, he took the crashed kite from my clutches and threw it into a corner, revealing a black and boxy object, which he placed carefully atop a highly polished coffin. I gave the hard finish a couple of sharp taps with my fingernail. Shellac, dissolved in methylated spirits, a coffin of the highest quality. Certainly not one of the cheaper finishes of linseed oil and lamp black, to which a bit of gold size in turpentine has been added. This box was meant for someone important. From my own personal experience, I knew a thing or two about the various varnishes and their qualities. An emergency repair of a 17th-century refectory tabletop at Buckshaw, ruined by my roller-skating on its polished surface, had once needed to be completed and invisible before Father got home from London. At the thought, a twinge touched my heart.
"I hope this camera's not busted," Hob said. "Or Pippin's going to slaughter me when he comes home."
"Pippin? Who is this Pippin?" I wondered. I raised my eyebrows.
"My brother," he said. "He's a pilot. Photo reconnaissance. He's mapping northern Canada for the Geological Survey. He used to fly a Spitfire. It's his camera. I nicked it for an experiment."
I could see the pride in Hob's eyes as the words came bubbling out of his mouth. Reflected in the polished gloss of the coffin, the camera had rather an unearthly look, a strange scientific instrument from another planet, sent, perhaps, to spy with its single, ever-open, all-seeing eye upon our backward world. And yet at the same time it was a perfectly ordinary Kodak Brownie 620. There were plenty of them about. Every tourist in every English village had one strapped around his or her neck, clicking away madly here and there at every quaint cottage, every tithe barn, and every duck on every village green. But this camera was different. A tiny hole had been drilled in the shutter release lever, to which had been fastened a length of fishing line that passed through a couple of small brass rings attached to the side of the camera.
"Have you got it worked out yet?"
Hob demanded, hopping from one foot to the other with excitement. "It's a cable release," I said. "A kind of remote control."
"Aerial photography!"
he exploded, unable to contain himself any longer.
"I knocked it together myself. Do you like it?"
"Extraordinary," I said, feeling much older than my actual years.
"Altogether ripping," I added,
more for my own benefit than for Hobbs.
Hob fairly basked in the glow of my approval, and I knew in that moment that he hadn't many friends.
"I have an idea," I said. "Let's take the film to the chemist's to be developed. I'll put it in my name, and you can put your brother's camera back wherever you found it. That way, he'll never know you even pinched it."
"You're brilliant," Hob said,
and I had to agree. A few moments later, the roll was in my pocket, along with my handkerchief, and whatever remained of the fluids from the lungs of the late Orlando. As I was giving myself a mental pat on the back, a door at the end of the loft swung silently open, and a man dressed entirely in black came into the room. He must have moved on oiled casters, I thought. Even my keen hearing had not detected his approach. He seemed almost as surprised to see us as we were to see him.
"Hob," he said, "what are you doing here? I thought you were out playing. And who's this you've brought home?"
I saved Hob the trouble of explaining, stepping forward in the most ladylike manner I could summon up. I offered him my hand and gave him a firm shake. Remarkably strong, I thought, for an undertaker. And yet, an undertaker had to be capable, when you got right down to it, of manhandling bodies as if they were so many sacks of potatoes. His suit was clean but shabby, the cuffs slightly frayed. From rubbing against so many coffins, I thought. An honest working man.
"I'm Flavia Deleuze, sir," I said. "Hob had a bit of a prang with his kite, and I helped him get it home."
"I'm much obliged to you, Miss Deleuze," he said. "Most grateful."
He extracted an old-fashioned pocket watch from his waistcoat, glanced at it, and said,
"But now you must excuse me. I'm afraid I have some rather urgent business to attend to, and—"
I knew what he was referring to, even before he finished speaking.
Orlando. It had to be Orlando.
What else could be so urgent in a small town on a lazy summer afternoon? How many deaths were likely to come to light within the space of a single hour? I fancied myself something of an expert on that topic. I knew, for instance, that most deaths in quiet country towns were due to old age, and that most of the elderly, when their time was up, tended to die quietly in the night and be discovered before breakfast. Deaths in the afternoon, on the other hand, were much more likely to be due to causes such as heart attacks among hard-working farmers, or road accidents involving young drivers with an appetite for alcohol and speed. There were other factors, of course, but these were the most likely.
"Of course, sir," I said, offering another shake. "It's been most pleasant to meet you."
"Pleasant? You genius, Flavia! Even old Peter Mark Roget, the thesaurus boffin, couldn't have come up with a better word himself. Not in 100 years. Not in an eon." Mr. Nightingale adjusted his widower's cuffs, and I knew I'd been approved. But just to make sure, I added,
I know you're extremely busy, sir, but I wanted to compliment you on your French polishing. I touched the gleaming coffin lid with appreciative fingertips. I noticed by the bottles in the courtyard that you use shellac and methylated spirits. I love the luster it gives. I caressed the highly polished wood. Mr. Nightingale straightened his tie. Sometime, when you have a minute, sir, you must give me your views on the use of bullions as an ornamental device. I realize there's a great deal of controversy, especially in dissenting parishes, but... I allowed my words to trail off. Bullions were the square-headed brass nails, beloved of undertakers, who wished to make a bit of easy profit at little expense. I had read up on them with great interest in Coffins and Coffin-Making, a well-thumbed copy of which was kept on a high shelf in the Bishop's Lacey Free Library. I excused my boldness by forcing a slight but pretty blush, which isn't as easy as it sounds. It's a matter of holding one's breath while forcing air from the lungs toward the head without appearing to do so.
"I am flattered, Mr. Luce," the undertaker said. "Perhaps another time."
I inclined my head graciously and gave him a coy smile. It was jolly good luck I didn't have a fan in my hand. Had he clicked his heels together, or was it my imagination? At any rate, he was suddenly, smoothly, and gracefully gone, just as you would expect from someone of his standing. "What a lovely man your father is, Hob," I remarked. He was grinning from ear to ear. "Now then," I told him, dropping my Duchess pose, "let's go find out what's on that film." Chapter 5. Fortunately, the chemist's shop was in the opposite direction from the church, so we were at little risk of running into anyone I knew. It simply wouldn't do to be stopped and ordered about by the police, although even that would have been better than coming face to face with Feely or Daffy. Feely! I had completely forgotten about her. I had walked out of the church with Constable Otter and left my sister producing a Niagara of notes on the church organ. For all I knew, she might still be at it. Old Johann's art of fugue, uninterrupted, could run on for as long as an hour and a quarter, especially if my sister was upset and had recently eaten. "Music has charms to soothe a savage breast," William Congreve had once written in his play The Mourning Bride.
"Music and chicken sandwiches, he ought to have said," Duffy once remarked, as Feely had stormed away from the dinner table and taken refuge in one of the most beautiful and heart-wrenching of the piano sonatas by Beethoven.
"Did you say you were going to pay for this?" Hob asked, interrupting my thoughts.
"Yes," I told him, "but let's hurry before I change my mind. If we cracked on with the film processing, I might be able to get back to the church and slip into a pew before Feely even noticed I was gone."
"What's the hurry?" Hob asked, shooting me a most penetrating look.
"Nothing really," I told him, biting my tongue. "It's just that I'm awfully keen on aerial photos. I haven't laid eyes on a good old aerial photo in simply ages. They used to print tons of them in the Illustrated London News, but that was before the war. Nobody gives a tinker's curse about them nowadays, except you, of course, and me." I shot him a beaming smile, and he beamed back. The chemist's was next door to a butcher's shop in the High Street. "Wanless and Sons Dispensing Chemists," it said in peeling black and gold above the door and on the little bow window, in which were displayed two glass globes of tired-looking coloured water. A bell tinkled brightly as we stepped into a dim, cramped Aladdin's cave of bottles, flasks, tins, bags and boxes. There was barely enough space in the place to turn around, and it smelled of sulphur, of lavender and mint, of bath salts and smelling salts, of licorice and aloes and nux vomica, of castor oil and oil of cloves, for toothache. The atmosphere, I realized with a sudden start, was that of a sick room, but the sick room of a patient who had quite recently departed this life. I didn't want to think about it. Behind an arched wire wicket, the chemist, tall, thin and white-jacketed, like a London tea-room attendant, didn't bat an eye as I handed over the film. "Prints?" he asked, his pencil poised. "One of each," I told him. "Name?" "Flavia Deleuze," I said. There was no point in lying about it. "Are you from our neighbourhood, Miss Deleuze?" he asked. "We're staying at the Oak and Pheasant," I said, "but we're expecting to leave tomorrow. Do you think they'll be ready by then?" This was pure invention. I had no idea when we were leaving, but I wanted the prints as soon as possible. The chemist frowned. "I can't promise anything. We process every day except Sundays, of course, but this is our busiest time of year." He didn't say because of the tourists, but I knew that's what he meant. I formed my mouth into a little pout to indicate that I might take my business elsewhere. "Sometimes," the chemist added reluctantly, "they're ready the same day, but only rarely. We're rushed off our feet this time of year, you know." I put on a guilty look, as if it were all my fault. He stared at me intently for a moment, and then, as if having come to some momentous decision, turned away and began to paw with his right foot at the wooden floorboards, as if he were a maddened bull who had just spotted the matador in the ring.
"Howland!"
he shouted in a new and alarmingly loud voice, quite unlike the one in which he had been speaking to me.
"When can you do a roll of 620?
Howland, whoever he was, must be remarkably hard of hearing. From under the floor there came an angry subterranean grumble, as if the gods of the underworld were suffering badly from indigestion. I could not make out any of the words. I peered round the edge of the wicket at which I was standing. Sure enough, there was a trapdoor beneath the chemist's feet. The invisible Howland must have his photo darkroom in the cellar.
"In due course," the chemist said, turning back to me.
"Thank you," I replied, baring my teeth and rewarding him with a full-on but well-chosen grin from my inner grab-bag of smiles. "I know you'll do your best," I said, and somehow I knew that he would. Outside in the high street, I said my goodbyes to Hob. "I must get back," I said. "Otherwise my sister will be frantic. She worries about me too much. You know how it is." A little untruth never hurt a casual acquaintance. Hob nodded and made off along the high street. Only after he was gone did I realize how few words he had spoken. As I walked back toward the church, I heard the unmistakable sound of a hurdy-gurdy. Was it a wandering organ grinder with his monkey? I wondered. A peripatetic pest, as Daffy would call him. My question was quickly answered as I came to a short passageway on the left side of the street. Through a brick archway was a cobbled lane that led to an open space beyond which were fields. I knew by the ancient stone cross and cattle troughs that this was a town marketplace, now taken over by a small travelling fair. A canvas banner announced that this was Shadrach's Circus and Menagerie, the grandest little show on earth. The music was coming from a small merry-go-round, its gaudy horses, pigs, griffins, and a single but fierce fire-breathing dragon spinning endlessly in the warm summer sunshine. There were no more than a handful of small riders astride these handsome beasts, and one of those, a red-faced little chap, was holding on for dear life and wailing for his mother. Nearby, a bored-looking elephant, shackled at the leg, munched half-heartedly on a mound of hay. Arranged round the four sides of the market square were the usual stalls: a coconut pitch and a pie man, a ring toss and an Aunt Sally,
Directly across from these was a shooting gallery with flying mechanical ducks, grouse, partridges, and a leftover portrait of Neville Chamberlain flying jerkily across a crudely painted landscape. Someone had painted a happy grin on Chamberlain's exhausted-looking face with lipstick. Beyond, in a row of side stalls, were games of crown and anchor, under and over, and, in spite of the ban on casino games at village fairs, a surprisingly large illuminated roulette wheel. A hand-lettered sign on a stick said, "No children, please." For the little ones, there was a fish pond with magnetic hooks to pull worthless trinkets from a cellophane pool.
"Hello there," said someone behind me, and I spun round to find myself face to face with one of the men I had seen in the pub,
the largest one. I recognized him by his polka-dot kerchief.
"Haven't we met before?" he asked. "Your face is familiar."
I knew better than to fall for a line like that. Daffy had coached me in dealing with strange men who claim that you have a familiar face. Her instructions ranged from the sharp retort and rapid departure all the way up to a swift kick in the colonies.
"You have to show them you mean business," Daffy had said.
I shook my head and turned away, but the man was not so easily discouraged. He shuffled round in front of me, blocked my way, and held out a roll of coloured tickets.
"Take a chance on the lucky draw," he coaxed. "Sixpence each, six for a shilling. What could be fairer than that?"
"Go away," I said quite loudly. That was step A.
"Come on," he persisted. "You look like a sport, a girl who likes to take a chance."
"Go away," I repeated. That was step B.
"Can't win if you don't enter," he said, going into a faint whine.
Step C was not to be executed unless a man physically laid hands upon you, but if he did, even so much as a finger, he was fair game.
"I'm warning you," I said.
A hand touched my upper arm. I swung round, spotted my target, and...
"Let's go, Flavia," Hob said, tugging at my sleeve. "You can buy me a candy floss."
I had come within an ace of flattening him. Had the little Dickens been following me? I gave him a raised eyebrow.
"You know as well as I do that sweets are still rationed."
"I do know that as well as you do," Hob grinned, "but I have a ration book." And so it was that the two of us, our faces covered with cobwebs of pink sugar, strolled back into the high street, licking our chops like butcher shop cats and wiping our sticky fingers on the leaves of overhanging trees. Gorging on sweets together creates a stronger bond between two people as being in love. Or so it seems to me, although I've never been in love. Nor am I much accustomed to sugar. The war had seen to that. And yet, walking along with Hob, both of us inhaling spun sucrose like a pair of jet engines, we became, almost instantly, old pals.
"How does it feel to have an undertaker for a father?" I asked.
It was a question I had been dying to ask him since the moment we met, a question to which, for some strange reason, I desperately required an answer.
"Do you really want to know?"
"Of course I do," I said, picking strands of pink fibre off my chin. "It's the kind of thing that interests me. I wish my father had been in the trade."
"Wasn't he?" Hob asked.
"No, at least not directly." I was thinking of Father's wartime service, when he and Dogger had been shipped out to the Far East in order to dispatch foreigners to an early grave. "Anyway," I said, pulling myself back into the moment, "you haven't answered my question." Hob shrugged.
"Well," he said, "they tease me about it at school."
"I'd rip their hearts out," I said, suddenly fiercely defensive of this tiny creature.
"Oh, I don't mind," Hob said. "Dar says that life is full of death,
and that it's better to make friends with it than fight it.
Oh, the wisdom of the man! It was as if the heavens had suddenly opened and a disembodied arm had handed down